We're talking about the Haggadah in anticipation of Pesach, in preparation of Pesach, for Pesach. And it's very unique. Let's see if we can note some of the things that are unique about Pesach, distinguishing it and differentiating it from the other holidays. Obviously, Chametz and Matzah, I mean, we know that. That's not what I mean. Because Sukkot, every holiday has its distinct theme. But I'm saying in the manner of observance, there is something very unique about Pesach. Well, first of all, the most significant time of Pesach is the night of Pesach. Basically, the first night of Pesach. Of course, our custom, whatever we have a second day. So, but that's only because of the custom of the exile. But basically, from the Torah, it's the night. So we'll just refer to it in that, from that standpoint. All of the mitzvot are performed at night. The major mitzvot of Pesach are performed on the night. What are the major mitzvot of Pesach? The Rambam, in his introduction to the laws of... he doesn't call it the laws of Pesach, interestingly enough. He calls it the laws of Chametz and Matzah. So he goes through the mitzvot. Well, you have the negative commands. The negative commands, of course, apply... The negative commands don't apply on this day or that day. They apply throughout the entire Pesach. But there is an additional factor, that is the 14th day, which we would call Erev Pesach. It assumes a special significance, unlike any other holiday. Pesach begins on the 15th day of Nisan. The 14th day of Nisan, we would call Erev, the eve of the holiday. Now the Erev, like Friday, is Erev Shabbos. It's the day prior to the Shabbos. And essentially it's dedicated to preparing for the Shabbos. But there's a difference between Erev Pesach and other days that are Erev, a Yom Tov. For example, there's a special mitzvah prohibition against eating chametz. The prohibition of eating chametz because of Pesach begins on the 15th, okay? But there's a special prohibition that one is not permitted to eat chametz on the 14th day from midday and on. That's a mitzvah from the Torah. So it's not just a question of taking an extra precaution. That's why everybody knows, Erev Pesach, you know, what's the time, what's the latest I can eat chametz, and what's the latest that I have to burn it, that kind of thing. So, from midday and on, there's a biblical prohibition against the consumption of chametz. Then there's another mitzvah on the 14th. Lahashpis se'or biyom arba'asa, to destroy leaven. That is, the destruction of chametz is a very special thing. Which means to say that it's not merely that one destroys it because you're not allowed to have it in your possession. That's what you would think. If you were to say that, then there'd be no special mitzvah of destruction. There would just be, get rid of it. And if a person stopped eating chametz a week before, or whatever, got rid of all of his chametz, of course it's true that he has to conduct the search. The Chachamim instituted the search. The search is done on the night before Erev, the night before the 14th. Okay, so it's the night of the 14th, excuse me. Because in the halacha calendar, the night comes first.
So the right, well, all that is really happening.
Now, that night of the 14th is when we have the search. The search is rabbinical. That is not something which is required midyaraisa. The rabbis instituted the search, basically to make sure that there is no chametz left by accident in your premises, essentially so that you shouldn't accidentally, either because of possession, you shouldn't possess it, even though you've nullified it. Nullification, that's also an interesting idea, the nullification. That the primary method of removing the chametz from your possession is through the nullification process. We all recite a formula of nullification. Once you recite the formula of nullification, that you regard it as the dust of the earth and you do not desire to possess it, At that point, from purely, it shows you how abstract the Torah is. The question is, if we're nullifying the chametz, and according to Torah categories, by virtue of the nullification, it's ownerless. It's not yours anymore. It's not yours anymore. And even if it should be, that's why it's very, very important to recite the nullification. Because if it should turn out that there was some chametz that you weren't aware of and it escaped all of the searches and it was there, and believe me, these things happen. Many, many cases, many times a person finds chametz in the strangest places. Maybe that's the title of a book. Finding chametz in the strangest places.
Yeah.
And there's people are horrified. Let's say you find it during Pesach. Did you violate the law? Were you in violation of the law? Well, you own chametz.
Everybody's free.
How is everybody free?
I'll tell you why.
It is a formula through which I renounce ownership of the object. And I'm not the owner. Such is a... there is room for such a formula. And this is... It's extraordinary because, of course, we know you can... You can remove your ownership. You can give something away. You could sell something. As soon as you give it away, so you're not the owner anymore. That itself is not a big deal. We know that. But here, there's a new concept. And that is that through the nullification process, through this declaration, of course, it has to be with intent. That is, a person can't just mouth the words. That's why, be careful, there's a formula in Aramaic. You got to know what you're saying. You should say it in English. Everybody should say it, by the way. I don't know. Women should say it as well as men. Because, generally speaking, the chametz that you own is owned by the husband. But it's not far-fetched. Nowadays, women have their own money. They could buy their own stuff. So you may have chametz in your car. You may have bought something and put it in the trunk and you forgot. It bypassed the search. The chametz detectors didn't notice it. So you recite the nullification. And from the standpoint of the Torah, at that point, even though you didn't transfer the ownership to somebody else, that's what's interesting about it. Even though you did not transfer the ownership to somebody else, you have ceased to be the owner. That is a mechanism. It's called bittul nullification. And even though it's in your possession, it's in your properties, but it's not yours. Just because something is in your house doesn't make it yours, obviously, we know that. But here, it's very important. Thus, if afterwards you discover chametz, at least you didn't violate the biblical prohibition. That's very important. At least you did not violate the biblical prohibition. Even it's not even shogeg. It's not even accidental.
What is the biblical prohibition?
Owning chametz on Pesach. Thus, the question is, what is the purpose of going through the search? Why do you have to go through the search? You just nullify. The basic reasons are, as you could see yourself, this is a very advanced, very abstract kind of a concept. And a person might have really good things, and he's just saying the words, but he doesn't really feel it in his heart. It's not. It lends itself to a certain amount of insincerity. And the formula only works when it's really sincere. So that's one reason. Secondly, there is the practical danger that the person might just forget. If there's chametz around the house, he didn't get rid of the chametz. If there's chametz around the house, then there's always the danger of habit. People are creatures of habit, as the Rambam says. And that's another reason for the severity that we attach to chametz. It's not the main reason. There's a philosophical reason for the severity, which I'll discuss at some point. But on a practical level, the additional precautions that you can't own it, you got to get rid of it, etc., etc. On a practical level, the reason is because there's two different types of prohibited foods. There's a very nice idea. There's prohibited foods which are prohibited all the time. You'll see a difference in attitude. You know, Jews like something like ham, or, you know, generally speaking, anything which is treif, which is known to be treif. So those are the kind of things that people stay away from all year. So it's very unlikely that accidentally a person is going to eat something like that. Even if it were in his house, you don't keep it in your house, but even since the prohibition is very powerful in a person's mind, he stays far away from that kind of stuff. He stays far away from that. So that we don't say that you can't go into a like a Friendly's or something and have ice cream there. The ice cream is kosher. You could go there and have ice cream. We don't say that you can't because since they also serve a cheeseburger over there, so you might accidentally just decide that it's not going to happen because there's a tremendous gap in your mind, a tremendous barricade, let's put it that way. It's really sealed. There's no danger that you're going to let down your guard and eat that. But since these are the foods that we eat all year long, and it's very, very, a lot of times a person is doing something like mindlessly, you might, in your coat, you might have some pretzels there. And during the course of the year, you nibble, you know, in the course of talking, you take out a pretzel and you nibble it. So then, I'm mentioning this case because it's something I myself witnessed. Once that a person in the middle of Pesach was, you know, rifling through their coat, and they pulled something out, and it was a pretzel, and they were like horrified. Because we tend to be forgetful. People are very, very forgetful. Unless you're a meticulous individual, but most people, and I'm not that way. I just always looking for what I put this book, what I do that, what I put here, where these gloves. I mean, I don't keep that kind of track of things, unless I'm forced to, whatever, but you lose track of things. So, if that's the case, you may have some chametz, let's say, in your pockets, if you that's what you do. You may have some chametz in your car, because you always keep something, crackers, just in case. Now, if that is the case, then what happens is we go into a certain mindless state. During Pesach, you go into the same mindless state, you're not cognizant, and you just reach out and you take the cracker, you can start eating it. Because it's something you eat all year long. You see, that would not happen with real tray food, which you're on guard against all year. So there is a unique way to treat this. That here in the Torah, we have a different phenomenon of something which is permitted becoming prohibited. And generally speaking, we tend to be more, interestingly enough, if somebody could find another example to back this up, I'm thinking of another example. The methodology of the Torah in dealing with prohibited things, in my opinion, is that we are more strict with things that are permitted and prohibited as opposed to things that are always prohibited. The laws of with Anida are more strict with one's wife than with another woman that's always prohibited to you. The laws are more strict. In terms of kind, the laws are pretty strict regardless of any prohibited woman, someone who's prohibited to you. So as we've mentioned that the laws are strict. You're not permitted to basically engage in contact of an affectionate nature. But all contact is discouraged. That is, all things being equal, you shouldn't hug or shake hands, certainly shouldn't kiss. And even if it's purely business-like, I mean, in the business context, sometimes people, when they greet, they give a little hug, whatever it is. So that's not technically prohibited because it's not affectionate, it's business. And shaking hands, we say with regard to shaking hands that it depends, it's not prohibited, but you should try and avoid it because it's contact. But in a business situation where it would cause embarrassment or discomfort, then you're permitted to shake hands with a woman. Now, with regard to, the laws are the most strict with regard to one's own wife, because one's own wife is permitted. So when she becomes prohibited because of Nida, the laws are much stricter. That is much restricting all kinds of contact. Even just touching, handing things to one another, and so on and so forth. Now, what's the reason for that? One would have thought the opposite. Now, normally, there's nothing wrong. You're permitted to hand an object, to hand a book to a woman, a married woman, not your wife, or an ordinary woman who's in need of, not your wife. There's no prohibition at all against handing something to her. Yet, when you're in marriage, you're prohibited from even handing something. What's the reason for that? I think it's the same idea. That you must have greater control and be on guard with regard to that which is permitted, because in your own mind it's not that severe. That's just the way we look at things. Emotionally speaking, the mind works in terms of absolutes, even though it's not irrational. You see, the human psyche is not always lined up with the rational concept. Because rationally, what difference does it make? Right now, it's a very serious prohibition. So Chametz on Pesach is a very serious prohibition. And that's it. That's when the prohibition comes into effect. The fact is that during the rest of the year, it doesn't have that status. That shouldn't make any... That doesn't make it less. When it's in effect, it's very severe. The fact that it's not always in effect has nothing to do with it. But the individual, looking at it emotionally, doesn't have that same taboo-ish kind of thing about it. Well, I eat that all year, you know. Like, for the average individual projects a certain kind of a quality to it, that there's something wrong with this thing. And since there's something wrong with it, it's prohibited all the time. The average individual American Jew, I don't know if he looks at chametz, unless he has this kind of an upbringing. Chametz on Pesach, I don't know that they take... I'm talking about Jews that are not really religious. But it's an amazing thing. This is a fact. I know this from people who, I mean, they have a Jewish attitude, they're traditional, but they're not really halachic, that many of the Italian restaurants, many of the non-kosher restaurants, at least in New York, you won't go into them, I can't, but
they make a Seder?
They, I don't know about a Seder, but they have matzah. They serve matzah for the Jewish customers. Can you imagine a thing like that? That is, these are Italian restaurants, everything is treif. And seriously, the meat is treif, it's been a lot of the cheese, they have cheese, meat and milk, because, you know, the ravioli dishes, etc., etc., and so on. And it's treif all year. But Jews who go in there on Passover, my God, here's a piece of matzah. So the guy feels good, he feels he's being Jewish, he's eating a piece of matzah with his ravioli on Pesach. I know that this is true because people have told me this. It's also true, however, that this is not universal, that there are those people who develop an even greater sense of urgency, a greater, I guess, for want of a better, fear about chametz. Many people to infuse it with the same type of a taboo-ish kind of a thing and become extremely, well, you know, with the extent of the cleaning and so on and so forth. So for those people who are very religious, they seize upon it, and the fact that it's permitted all year long does not prevent them from investing it with tremendous significance on Pesach too. I guess the point would be for the ordinary Jew who's not that scrupulous, who's somewhat scrupulous, but you could see it. You could see that the danger that, given that people are creatures of habit, and a lot of times you just do things mindlessly and don't even realize what you're doing, you just grab things and you start nibbling, you're not aware, that those are the reasons. The reasons that the rabbis mandated that one should search the house. Search the house and do what we do all the things. Search the house, recite the nullification, and we also burn the chametz. The burning of the chametz, that's what the Rambam is talking about over here. Well, it's an argument whether the lahashpis. Lahashpis means to destroy. Now, what is that? Is the idea of destroying basically the avoidance of a negative, or is it a positive in its own right? That's the question I'm asking. Let's say I don't have any chametz, because I'm a wheat-free kind of a person, flour-free, whatever it is. I stopped eating, or I'm on this special diet, whatever the case may be. I don't eat chametz. So I have nothing in my house that is chametz. And bear in mind that legumes, we don't eat it, but there's no obligation to get rid of it. There's no prohibition of owning corn and peas and all that stuff. You don't have to sell that. So I have no chametz. What happens on the day of the 14th? How do I do the mitzvah of lahashpis, of destroying? Do I have to go out to the bakery and buy a roll in order to destroy it? Or no? If I don't have, I don't. Am I missing a mitzvah, though? Is it a mitzvah to destroy in its own right? There are those who say that you accomplish the mitzvah of destruction with nullification. There are those who say that no, that it means to actually physically to destroy it. Physically destroying it, which we do basically by burning it. That's the standard way, by burning it. Or by breaking it into little pieces and throwing it into the sea, in which case it gets the water will destroy it. All right, well, let's just focus. As I said, the standard way is burning it, making a fire and burning it. And they say that that is the mitzvah of destroying it. So what we do is a number of things because of the seriousness. As I said, this is the way it's done. We search the premises for chametz. Those who sell their chametz, let's put it this way, there's different categories of chametz then. Those who sell the chametz have sold the chametz. So this chametz doesn't belong to them. That's not even theirs. They're not concerned about that. Okay? What they then do is to do a search for anything that they did not include in the sale. Perhaps there's a box of cereal in the playroom, whatever. Perhaps there's an open box of cookies, etc. They're doing a search. They conclude the search. If they don't find anything, they don't find anything. They then proceed to recite the nullification because it's possible that there's still stuff out there that I didn't find. You see? Or that I'm not aware of. I can have chametz somewhere that I'm not aware of. So you recite the nullification. Then, what you do is on the next day, if you found chametz, so you destroy it. You do that's the chametz that you're going to destroy. The chametz you sold, you're not going to destroy. It's not your chametz. Obviously, there's no mitzvah. Let's make it clear. There's no mitzvah just to destroy chametz per se. The mitzvah is to destroy your chametz. You see? So to just go and burn somebody else's chametz doesn't make any sense. That's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to burn your own. Okay, one second. When you do that, you've covered all the bases in terms of getting rid of chametz. You've done the nullification, and whatever chametz you're... And you've also... The nullification protects you against the violation of owning. That protects you against the violation of owning. Now, the backup protection against the violation of owning and possible accidental eating of it on Pesach is the search. So you got that backup. And now, the 14th, the Rambam says there's a mitzvah of Tashbisu to destroy. The question is there an intrinsic mitzvah? I mean, is that true only if you have chametz at that time? But if you don't, you don't. Or no, you have to have chametz, that's the mitzvah. So, just like any other mitzvah, no one's going to say that it's a mitzvah to eat matzah if you have matzah. If you don't have matzah, you got to go out and prepare. So, same thing over here. Do we say that if you don't have chametz, you go out and get it for the sole purpose of doing the mitzvah, burning it? The definition of a place which requires a search is a place in which chametz may be found. Let's say it's a kid's room, a playroom, even if they don't eat their meals there, but if it's not scrupulous that they run in sometimes and they bring a snack, so that's a place. We're very strict on that count. If it's a place where the kids might bring food in, so that room needs to be searched. However, from what point of time and on would be from a month from Purim, basically. So that if you want to avoid a search, if you clean out the house before Purim, clean out some rooms, inspect them, etc., then you mark off those rooms. And the law in the house is nobody may enter those rooms with chametz. Then those rooms are exempted from a search. Because they're not defined as places in which people bring chametz into. So if a person wanted to do that, they could lighten up the load. Once you're into the month, though, I know that people are tempted to do it. Instead of having to search on that night, what they want to do is start a week earlier and then to do this room and search it. Start a week earlier and do the other room. That's not going to exempt you from a search. Even though you're convinced that there's nothing is there, you're negating the decree of the rabbis. The rabbis universalized it and they established a mitzvah with a blessing and a time The only time you could search early, you can search earlier. Here's the time when you could, here's the way you can search earlier. You could search earlier if you're going away for Pesach. So if you're going away for Pesach, that doesn't exempt you from the search, even though you're not going to be in the premises. Then you the time would be the night, the last night that you'll be there before you leave. Okay, so if you're leaving 2 days before, whatever it is, the last night that you will be in the house before you leave, you do the search, and then you do it without the blessing. Because the blessing is only when you do it at the preordained time. When that time comes, it's a mitzvah to search. If you don't search, you're negating the mitzvah. And if your answer is, well, I know there's nothing there because I searched yesterday, you still didn't do the mitzvah. Now, of course, let me just add something to that. The way to make it easier is if there's advanced preparation, if you organize the room and so on and so forth, right? So then you can go quickly with your searchlight or whatever you use. You're allowed to use a searchlight. You go through the room. If it's organized, go through it quickly and you do a search. I mean, you can't just make believe, though. You got to do the search. The reason why the search takes a long time is if there's a lot of mess in the room, so you had to go through this and go through that, it takes a long time. But if it's organized, okay, if it's organized, so then, the search goes much quicker. Unfortunately, there's a big misunderstanding about the mitzvah, especially today when we have big houses and so on and so forth, and there's also the idea of spring cleaning, and everybody wants to make their house crystal clear and clean. Technically speaking, it's not that difficult. The Chacham did not mandate that Pesach be a time of spring cleaning. The way the Jews have conduct themselves and this tremendous anxiety and this concept that everything must be crystal clean, that's not the Torah. Technically speaking, it's very easy. That you do whatever you want to do. You do whatever you want to do. And the night before, you just do a search. You know, the place doesn't have to be clean, other than clean for the holiday. I mean, there's no mitzvah of clean. It means that you search for chametz. That's it. Get rid of your chametz, and that's all you have to do. You don't have to. People like with the same thing with their cars. They bring the car in. This is the time of the year when your car gets cleaned. Inside, outside, it's crystal clear. There too. If you don't bring chametz into the car, you don't even have to search. If you do, so you search. Now, the difficulty there you can see the difficulty. Since there's so much junk under the seats and all that, without cleaning it, you can't do a search. Then you have to clean it. If the place is in a state where without the cleaning it, you couldn't do the search, then you have to clean it so you could do the search. But let's say you've done that, how long does it take? You take a flashlight, you look under the seat, that's it. If you find, you find. If you don't find, you don't find.
Wait a minute, the car?
The Rambam in chapter 2, the laws of chametz and matzah, says it's a positive command of the Torah to destroy, we'll use the word destroy, chametz, before the time of the prohibition of eating. As it says, on the first day you shall destroy the leaven from your houses. And the first day is a reference to the day before, the 14th. Okay. Now, what is, then in the next halacha, and what is this hashbasa, the Hebrew term? Which is, what does it mean? Which the Torah is talking about. It is that he should nullify it in his heart and should regard it as dust and consider it in his heart that there is no chametz in his rishus at all. In his possession at all, and that all the chametz which is in his possession, it is like dust and something for which one has no need at all. Of course, and then he goes on to say, and rabbinically speaking, there's the mitzvah to search. Then he goes into the search. As we said, that's an extension. As far as the Torah is concerned, you fulfilled your requirement with the nullification. The Rambam regards the nullification as fulfilling the requirement of the destruction. Destruction here does not mean physical destruction, but rather the nullification. Any chametz which was owned by a Jew during Passover is prohibited not just to eat it, but to derive benefit from it. That's the whole issue of what stores you could buy from. Ironically, after Pesach, we're concerned about buying from Jews. if we don't know, if they're not religious Jews, if the store, we need to know, was this chametz owned by a Jew during Passover? And we prefer, after Passover, to purchase from a Gentile store, a supermarket, whatever, that has Gentile ownership, because that's not a problem. Any chametz that was owned by a Gentile during Passover is fine. It's only chametz that was owned by a Jew. So if you nullified it, that nullification will save you from violating the Torah prohibition against ownership. But if it was in your, if you didn't get rid of it though by selling it, if you kept it, then it's prohibited to use. You can't use it. You can't even give it to a friend because you're deriving benefit from it. That is, it's a gesture of friendship, and they, whatever it is, you're deriving, when you give a gift to someone, that you derive a certain amount of pleasure from it, from and benefit from it. What you could do is to leave it for the homeless. In that sense, you're not deriving any benefit whatsoever. You're not getting anything in return, so you leave it for the homeless. There is a position that holds that there is a mitzvah to burn it, to physically destroy it. Not just the nullification. It's obvious the Rambam doesn't hold that way. At this point in time, we're going to put the question aside because we need more information. We need more information that's very, very important. What is the significance? Why did the Torah make such a big thing out of chametz and matzah? Okay, we understand it's easier to understand the mitzvah of matzah. We understand. We say that at the Seder, we explain what the matzvah represents. That the matzah represents the redemption. So fine, so we're reenacting the story, and we could understand that. But what's not so clear is the severity of chametz. Why must we prohibit chametz, and why is it so serious? And by the way, the penalty for chametz is very, very severe. Much more severe than ordinary prohibited foods. Because the penalty for eating chametz on Pesach, if a person did it knowingly, intentionally, is what we call kares. Kares means the destruction of the soul. The soul is cut off. So kares, when you hear kares, you know it's very, very serious. Kares is for Chilul Shabbos. It's for Yom Kippur, if a person violates Yom Kippur. It is for the most serious of the sins. So it's up there with the most egregious sins. The most serious sins, generally speaking, carry the death penalty and kares. For example, Shabbos. A person violates Shabbos, he is subject to the death penalty. But that's only, we can't do that today. We don't have the death penalty, we don't have the Sanhedrin. But it does carry the kares penalty. Barring tshuva, of course, if the person didn't do tshuva. So, when you hear kares, you know it's the most serious. That is a big problem because at first glance, it's not obvious what is so terrible about chametz. The other forbidden foods, from all year long, what we call chazer, things like that, pig, don't carry the kares penalty. They're prohibitions. They're violating a negative command. Now, they're serious. They're not light, but they're not in the same league. Kares is the most significant thing. So that's what we need to understand, why it is that something which doesn't seem to be that terrible, to eat chametz, is very, very, very serious. Well, you see how many laws are tied up with it. Generally, there's no obligation to get rid of it, to destroy it. There's many, many obligations. All right, we'll come back to that theme. We're just going to continue, though, with the listing of the mitzvos pertaining to Pesach. Okay? We continue now. So the first one is not to eat chametz on the 14th. It's a separate prohibition of eating chametz on the 14th. You see how many laws there are pertaining to the eating of chametz. The second one is the mitzvah to, according to the Rambam, to nullify the chametz on the 14th. Then it says not to eat chametz kol shiva. So there are two prohibitions of chametz. One is specifically for the 14th day. The other one is for the holiday of Pesach. So you have two time slots in which chametz is prohibited. A, the 14th is a prohibition in its own right. Well, basically, that's what's the significance of the 14th? Everybody should know, what's the significance of the 14th? What gives it the specialness? What gives it a certain level of holiness? Is that is the time when the Passover sacrifice is brought, is offered. It's eaten at the night. But the time for the bringing of it and the slaughtering of it is on the 14th. That's what gives the 14th the signification. So from that point in the day, from midday and on, it becomes invested with the special designation of being the time of the Passover sacrifice, and therefore there's a prohibition of chametz. You can't have chametz in conjunction. You can't sacrifice the Passover sacrifice. You can't bring it, rather, in a state of chametz, where there's still chametz in your possession, and when you're still going to be eating chametz. So you have to have separated yourself from chametz, so to speak, in order to render it fit for the Passover sacrifice. That's the beginning, that's the opening phase of Passover, is the sacrifice. The 14th is the day of the sacrifice. Then at night you have, but there's still not Pesach yet. Pesach does, interestingly enough, Pesach does not come into existence until the night. The night of the 15th is the beginning of Pesach, and the law of the entire Pesach is that you can't eat chametz on the entire Pesach. That's a separate law. So that obviously the law of the 14th expires. Now you come into Pesach and there's a commandment not to eat. Then there's another one that you can't eat an admixture of chametz. The Rama maintains that the prohibition on Pesach itself, again, chametz, exists in two forms. One is bread, pure chametz, and the other one is an admixture. If there's an admixture of chametz, like beer, things in which chametz is mixed together in, even though it's not bread, that's another violation. Then shelo yirah chametz kol shiva. You shouldn't see, or it should not be seen. Chametz should not be seen. What does that mean, it shouldn't be seen? That means it shouldn't be in your premises. When you translate that halachically, it doesn't mean that if you see a picture of chametz, or you walk down the street and there's a roll and you look at it, there's no violation. It means it shouldn't be around, shouldn't be visible. Meaning it shouldn't be in your possession. Now the next mitzvah is identical pretty much. Shelo yimatzei chametz kol shiva. It shouldn't be found. Shouldn't be seen, shouldn't be found. Are two negative commandments, all of which revolve around one condition of ownership. If you have ownership, that means it's seen and it's found. So how many we have now? Four separate commandments pertaining to some kind of a negation of chametz. Four. Two of them are eating. Actually, three are eating. One is the 14th when you can't eat it. Then you can't eat it on Pesach. Then you can't eat an admixture. Excuse me, we have five.
Six.
Well, six, we have more? Maybe I'm not counting right. Actually, you're right, there's six. There are six commandments over here dealing with chametz. Three of them pertaining to eating. Three pertaining to eating. One is the eating of the 14th. Then you have the second one, the eating of during Pesach, and the third one is eating the admixture during Passover. That's three. Then you have two pertaining to removing, that it shouldn't be found, rather. Shouldn't be found, shouldn't be seen. That's two. And then you have lahashpis, to nullify. According to the Rambam, it's the nullification. So altogether you have six commandments, five negative, one positive, pertaining to chametz. Then there are two mitzvos left. Positive. Lechol matzah b'leilei Pesach. There's one mitzvah pertaining to matzah. To eat matzah on the night of Pesach. Then he says, L'saper b'tzias mitzrayim b'yosu ha'layla. To discuss, to tell the story of the Exodus on that night. Okay? So, getting back to one original question, the mitzvah is incumbent upon women. All the mitzvot that we're talking about pertain to women. Even though they're time-bound, you could have the old question, they're positive mitzvot and they're time-bound. Women are included because women were included in the miracle. Women were included in the liberation. Women were included in the miracle. So all the mitzvot that we perform, plus the additional ones, the rabbinic mitzvot of the four cups of wine, and the reclining, Oh, that's a separate issue. It's a question about women, whether women recline, but we'll get into that. But the most of the mitzvos, as we've seen, and certainly the severity, is to do with chametz. The whole thing revolves around chametz. Chametz has been singled out for special attention. It's the so-called villain.